This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. Cancer may be the single most dreaded word in the English language. We all know that medicine has made huge strides and that the diagnosis is not necessarily a death sentence, but cancer is still the second leading cause of death in this country, and the most effective treatments, radiation, surgery, and chemotherapy, can be painful and debilitating. Now, though, a new generation of cancer drugs is beginning to become available. Smart drugs that target cancer on a microscopic level with many fewer side effects. 20 years ago, Dr. John Mendelsohn helped create and develop one of the most promising of these new cancer drugs. It's called C225, and it's in phase 3 of its clinical trials. It's been shown to be effective with few and relatively minor side effects. Dr. Mendelsohn is now president of the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. He's also a professor of medicine there, and he serves on the board of InClone Systems, the company that's developing C225. When Dr. Mendelsohn started his research 20 years ago, there was just a handful of promising anti-cancer drugs in development. Today, more than 400 are in the pipeline. I asked him, what's changed?
Well, a lot has changed, and it boils down to the fact that we understand the cause of cancer. Cancer is caused by mutations or malfunctions in certain genes that regulate the growth of cells. And if these are functioning improperly, the cells either die or they grow at an incredibly advantaged way compared to the other cells and become cancer.
What about this process do we understand better?
Well, we've got a catalog now. The Genome Project has identified around 30,000 genes. And that's a great telephone book now with 30,000 addresses in it. So we know where each of these genes is located. But we don't know what goes on at most of those addresses. We've got a lot of work to do still. But we do know that about 400 of those genes are very important for controlling cell growth and cell proliferation. And if one or two of those genes that control cell growth out of that list of 400 is functioning improperly, the cell's in trouble. That might be if you're driving your car and the foot brake doesn't work and the steering is very difficult. You can still use your handbrake and you can still stop and save yourself. But if three or four of those genes that are critical are not working in your car, your accelerator is stuck down, your steering wheel stops working and your brakes don't work, you're either going to crash or you're going to win the race if the road's straight. And that's really what happens in cancer. If three or four of those genes that control proliferation are abnormally functioning, the cell either dies, which is what we'd hope, or it goes on to become malignant. And now that we've identified these genes, we have targets. Chemotherapy in the past was using toxins and poisons that we were trying to tame and make useful for the treatment of cancer.
The treatment was almost as bad as the disease.
Well, I wouldn't go that far because it did cure the disease sometimes. But the first anti-cancer agent came from mustard gas in World War I when the poor soldiers were dying because the mustard gas got in their lungs. The doctors noticed that their white blood cell counts went down before they died. And after the war, they tried to harness mustard gas, and they created a drug called nitrogen mustard, which they could give in the vein in a controlled way. And they used this to treat disorders of white blood cells, and it was effective.
Leukemia?
Leukemia and lymphoma, especially lymphoma and Hodgkin's disease, actually.
Now, when these cells stop working properly, is that because we've inherited bad genes from our parents?
Well, it's a very important question, because now that we know that genes are the target, it doesn't mean that this is all a hereditary problem. Genes can be abnormal for two reasons. We might inherit defects in those genes, or we might acquire the defects in the genes from the environment. And we believe that in the majority of cases, the abnormal genes come from the environment. And we feel that about a third of all the abnormalities that are created that cause cancer come from the carcinogens in tobacco smoke.
A third?
So it's a third. If we all quit smoking, one-third of all cancers would go away. No more gene research, no more pharmaceuticals, just go away. It's the most important thing I can say on this program. If everyone quit smoking, one-third of all cancers would disappear.
Now, is this, you're now able to understand how this operates at the molecular level. So as opposed to the broad stroke, the broad brush approach of chemotherapy or radiation treatment, is this now the equivalent of a smart weapon that zones in on precisely the right target?
That's right. The drug companies, the big drug companies, the biotech companies, and all the academic institutions in the country are zeroing in and collaborating, I think, fairly effectively to design targeted therapies that will fix the problems that these 300 or 400 abnormal genes can create. And we might replace the gene. The gene product is called a protein. We might disarm that protein, or we might put in a protein that is more effective than the one that's abnormal. There's a lot of different approaches to attack the problem that any particular gene abnormality creates.
In the past, cancer researchers have been incredibly reluctant to use words like optimism, breakthrough, certainly cure, because of the enormous weight that so many people put on this. There are so many people who've so desperate for any kind of a cure, and we've all heard stories of people going to Mexico to get Laetril and all these other things. Yet now people are speaking in real optimistic phrases. Is this justified in your view?
It's justified, but it has to be cautious. This is not a case of one big home run, one great discovery that will eliminate all cancers. As I explained, there are probably 400 different targets that we're going to have to develop anti-cancer agents that will affect. And it's usually a combination of 4 or 5 of these targets that are abnormal that result in cancer. Now, there's been one wonderful breakthrough that I'm sure you'll bring up, so I'll bring it up, and that's Gleevec. It's a drug that treats chronic myelocytic leukemia. That's a disease of the white blood cells in the bone marrow that get out in the blood. Now, in that particular form of cancer, we believe that one gene abnormality is the cause of the cancer rather than the usual 4 or 5 that I mentioned, and It could be 6 or 7. And so when a drug was developed that could disarm the product of that particular gene that causes chronic myelocytic leukemia, we had just striking results in patients.
You said an interesting thing, particular kinds of cancer. It's important to understand that this is not one disease, but a lot of different diseases.
Right. I think the way we've thought about cancer in the past is it's in the breast, or it's in the lung, or it's in the brain, and the tissue where the cancer occurred was the target. Now we're thinking that cancer can occur in any of those areas, but it might be some of the same genes causing the cancer, whether it appeared in the brain or in the colon or in the lung. The most common gene abnormality we've discovered so far, and we as the collective scientific community,
sure,
is P53, which was the molecule of the year in Science magazine a few years ago. And P53 is abnormal in the majority of all cancers. So we're treating P53 problem rather than colon cancer or lung cancer. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And as you look at, for example, if I were a patient, you would look at my disease on the molecular level rather than saying there's a spot on your lung, you've got lung cancer.
That's right. Stanley Hamilton is our new head of pathology, and we recruited him here to set up a program where we're going to do gene screening on all cancers from all patients. So when the PATH specimen comes from Mrs. Smith's breast cancer and is sent to the pathology department, in the past, we'd look in a microscope and we'd stain the specimen with some dyes that were invented in Germany in the late 1800s, and we'd say this is breast cancer or it's not breast cancer and it looks more aggressive or less aggressive. But in the future, a piece of that tumor will be sent to the molecular pathology lab rather than the microscope lab, and we're going to get a list of the 5 or 6 genes that are abnormally expressed in that particular patient's cancer.
So if you're not devising, you know, one single magic bullet that will eliminate this entire range of diseases, are you convinced that now you guys are on the right track, that this is the right approach, and that this is just the beginning?
I believe that very strongly, and I think the best analogy is infectious disease. If you go back 100 years to the year 1901, Pasteur and Koch and a lot of really wonderful scientists had determined that bacteria caused some of the major diseases in our lives. The most common cause of death in 1901 was pneumonia, and the second most common cause of death was tuberculosis. And at that time, we had identified the cause. Now, it wasn't a list out of 400. It was a list in pneumonia. There were half a dozen bugs that caused most pneumonias. In tuberculosis, it's one kind of tuberculosis germ, although it can deviate and get resistant. And once that had been discovered, science got busy and said, let's make targeted chemotherapy against those germs. Now, that chemotherapy is called antibiotics. And today, if you get pneumonia, you go to the doctor and you cough into a plate, and the next day the report comes back and tells the doctor which germ caused your pneumonia. And in most cases, in the cases of viruses, we don't have good treatment yet, but in most cases, which are bacterial, the report tells you which antibiotic will work against that germ. And you treat it, and pneumonia is no longer the first cause of death. It's down the list, and tuberculosis is off the top 10 because we have specific treatments. We'll never get rid of those diseases, but we've reduced their burden on public health. And the same thing, I think, will be happening in cancer. It's more complicated. The list is 400, we believe, and we could be off a bit. And any one cancer has a number of genes that are malfunctioning, so we're going to need a cocktail of targeted treatments to treat the cancer.
My guest is cancer researcher Dr. John Mendelsohn. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Dr. John Mendelsohn, president of the University of Texas MD Anderson Center in Houston. And Dr. Mendelsohn, this is a story of these new cancer drugs that you, amongst many others, are developing that seems to involve, bold and innovative research, but bold and innovative entrepreneurs as well. Tell us the story of C-225.
Well, back in 1980, I was on the faculty at the University of California, San Diego, working with a colleague named Dr. Gordon Sato. And at that time, we were studying the epidermal growth factor receptor. Now, just briefly, there's on the surface of cells, there are receptors that are like locks. And around the cells, there are stimulators of those receptors. Those are called growth factors that are like keys. Mm-hmm. And the analogy I make is if you get into a car, you got to put a key into the lock and turn the ignition, and that sends a signal, an electric signal that starts the motor and puts on your power brakes and your power steering and the lights and everything goes. But if you don't put that key in that lock, nothing happens. The same thing controls the growth and proliferation of cells. There's locks on the surface of the cell and there's keys. The locks are called receptors and the keys are called growth factors. What we knew in 1980 was that there was, from the work of Dr. Stanley Cohen, who won the Nobel Prize for this, we knew that there was a very important lock called the epidermal growth factor receptor, and there was a key called epidermal growth factor. So we had also learned from the scientific literature that there were cancer cells that expressed very high levels of this receptor. And
now, when you say that, you mean that this chemical shows up in excess amounts when you've got a certain kind of cancer.
Right. It turns out many kinds of cancer. The data subsequently have shown that in about one-third of all cancers, there's huge numbers of these locks on the surface of the cell. And Dr. George Todaro and Dr. Michael Sporn published a paper in 1980 summarizing exciting data showing that cancer cells produce their own keys. So the cancer cell produces the key, epidermal growth factor. It excretes this key outside the cell. The key latches onto the lock and turns the ignition, and the cancer cell auto-stimulates itself to proliferate. Now, normally that key doesn't come from the cell. It comes from the environment. If you get a cut on your hand, the epidermal growth factor is carried in the bloodstream. And it stimulates the cells to proliferate, and your wound heals. And as everything heals up, the epidermal growth factor goes away, and the cells stop dividing. But in the cancer case, there were models that we had developed. We and many others had done this, and Dr. Todaro led this, had shown that cancer cells make their own keys and auto-stimulate themselves. So we decided we'd try to block this process by essentially creating a piece of chewing gum that would stick into the lock so the key couldn't get in. And we created an antibody to do this. It was called 225. It was a 225th antibody we studied out of thousands. And this antibody binds to the epidermal growth factor, the receptor, the way antibodies bind to all kinds of molecules. But we selected one that would bind to the very site where the key goes in and blocked the function of the key. And that's why there's such a variety of new drugs coming along. I mean, just attacking the epidermal growth factor receptor, there are at least half a dozen approaches now that are all competing and looking in patient trials to see which will turn out to be the most effective.
Now, yours turned out to be a terrific idea, but from your description, this really does fit Thomas Edison's description of 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration.
Well, it was a lot of work to find this antibody, but I think it was a confluence of information coming from many different scientists that led to this idea, and I think it shows that science from many different directions, I mean, nobody would have guessed when epidermal growth factor was discovered. It was discovered because it helped the maturation of teeth in embryos. Okay, that's really pretty far away from cancer.
Yeah.
And Stanley Cohen worked on this. It was a sort of a far-out field. Nobody really knew how important it was until 15 years later. And by 20 years later, he won the Nobel Prize for his work.
Now, as we pick up the story of C225, this new company, ImClone Systems, is beginning production of it. What kinds of cancers does it attack, and how successful is it?
Well, ImClone has produced an awful lot of this antibody. We've treated over 500 patients now. And incidentally, answering your question, it turns out that about a third of all cancers express high levels of EGF receptor. Now, we've concentrated on head and neck cancer, where 90% of the cancers or more express high levels of EGF receptor. And we've looked at advanced bowel cancer, that's in the colon and the rectum. And in that case, probably a third to a half of the patients express high levels of EGF receptor. And we've looked at pancreas, where the majority of patients express high EGF receptor levels. But this could be relevant in lung cancer for well over half. It could be relevant in about 20% of breast cancers, in 30 or 40% of ovarian cancers, in advanced prostate cancer, in bladder cancer. So it doesn't matter where the cancer is. What matters is if that cell depends on the EGF receptor as its key ignition to stimulate proliferation.
And how effective is it?
Well, the initial trials have shown safety. And last May it was at the meeting of the American Association for Cancer Research, three clinical trials were reported looking at combining antibody C225 against the EGF receptor with chemotherapy in head and neck cancer and in colon cancer and in pancreas cancer. And in all cases, we were able to show that adding the antibody increased the efficacy. Now, this isn't 100%, and the tumors didn't shrink forever. Some of them are still responding, but some of the tumors escape. But this was proof of principle, and this is how it works. You're taking advanced cancer when you're doing something with a new drug. This is proof of principle that adding C225 to chemotherapy can obviously improve the effect of chemotherapy alone, because the patient served as his or her own control. They were finding the tumor was growing. The tumor was responsive to the chemo. It had responded. It was now escaping it. And then when we added the C225, again, the tumor was responding.
When this comes out, if it's as promising as you believe it will be, who's going to make the money?
ImClone and its investors will make money.
Among whom, we should say, are you. You're on the board of ImClone Systems, right?
I'm on the board. I joined the board of ImClone in 1996, as I remember. And they have given me some stock options, so I do have it's way less than 1% of the company, but I do have some interest. And I must say that because of this, I am not treating any of the patients. I don't believe that someone who has a potential financial gain from an experimental therapy should be the person that's treating a patient. The patient has to feel that there's no even possible conflict of interest, and their health has to be the primary thing. So that's why I've held back. But the University of California owns the patent, and they will get funds through the license agreement. And I think the money will go to those that have taken the risk and have put up the capital. ImClone has invested well over $100 million, and it probably will be $200 million in this project by the time everything is signed and sealed. And we don't know yet that this is going to be an approved drug. I want to emphasize that. C225 is still an experiment. Obviously, the fact that we're talking about it together is because there have been very exciting data showing that it seems to be working well, but you haven't crossed home plate until you cross home plate. So this is still an experiment, and the people that are investing in this still are taking some risk.
Dr. Mendelsohn, thank you so much, and I think on behalf of everybody listening, good luck.
Well, thank you very much, and you're wishing good luck to thousands of investigators that are exploring these new approaches to cancer diagnosis and treatment.
Dr. John Mendelsohn helped create and develop C225, a cancer drug that's currently in phase 3 clinical trials. He's president of the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, and a professor of medicine there.